When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to TIFO Talks, the fun time miniseries, 8 episodes. This is episode 5. And this one, who are we joined by, John?
Well, I'm not joined by anyone because I wasn't invited to this one.
That's right. You were excluded from your own podcast.
That's right.
And even more amusingly, not only am I on it, but JJ Bull and Seb Staffel-Blore are also on it.
Yes.
And you're, in fact, conspicuously the only person not on it.
It may be the case that the initial success of the podcast has made the rest of the group jealous.
Yes.
And they've kicked me off.
That's right. And we've clamoured to join. And we've clamoured to join with a very special guest today. And that special guest is Humphrey Carr. Who is a comedian, an actor, a writer, but also perhaps most noteworthy for listeners of this podcast as the executive director of Wrexham AFC. Yes, that's right. Have you enjoyed the series, John?
I have not watched it.
Okay, well, that's very much in your character, isn't it? But I can tell you that I have watched it, and whilst this isn't actually a conversation about the series, it is very, very good. So if you do want to watch it, I would encourage you to do so. We spoke to Humphrey about the idea of sort of living out a dream. At one stage I ask him, I say, as a child you dream of being a footballer, as a young man you dream of being a football coach, and as a wise old man, when you realize that your physical life is behind you, the only dream you're left, you allow yourself to continue having, is maybe I could run a football club. Mm. And whilst Humphrey Carr admits that he doesn't run Wrexham, he is in a position of seniority and has a very unusual level of insight for someone who, prior to arriving, had zero experience working professionally in football. So we talk about that. We talk about the state of play at Wrexham at the moment. We find out how Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds became interested in the Wrexham project in the first place. For anyone that doesn't know, I assume everyone knows.
Everyone knows.
I think everyone knows. But Ryan Reynolds, who is a Hollywood movie star, and Rob McElhenney, who is a Hollywood TV star, have joined forces to buy non-league Wrexham AFC. And Humphrey is their sort of budding friend, their man on the ground.
We should probably have begun with this bit, shouldn't we?
Maybe we should have done.
Yeah. Oh, well.
But anyway, that's all for the intro. Hope you enjoy today's episode, and come back next week for more John McKenzie.
Mm. Do you know what my dream is?
What's that?
Working for you, Joe.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and I'm delighted to be joined by a very special guest this day. It's Humphrey Carr. Hello, Humphrey.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming. Humphrey, you are the executive director of AFC? Wrexham or Wrexham AFC?
Wrexham
AFC. And people will have seen you upon the screens in their homes.
Yes.
In the Welcome to Wrexham documentary series.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. We're also joined by JJ and Seb. Hi, guys.
Hello.
That was a very more damp introduction for the two of you.
I felt like that was a bit, but I want to be, you know. I want the main guest to know how important
but
they
I
are.
But I still immediately
feel like very important.
Do you?
Oh, yeah.
That's good. We'll chip it down over the course of the next bit of time. Can you tell me first, please, how you became involved in this thing and what happened?
Yes. So at the start of the coronavirus lockdown fest that we had from March 2020 onwards in the US and the UK and around the world, I was working as a writer on the Apple TV critically ignored sitcom Mythic Quest,
which is very good, by
it
way.
Is thank you
I
very
really
much.
I really enjoyed it.
Thank
Mythic
you thank
Quest.
You yeah. We got dominated by Ted Lasso on that platform,
yeah.
But it's a bit of a hidden gem, I think, and I was working for Rob McElhenney as one of his writers, and I would quite often in that room sit and watch football, and I was there from I think early 2019 through to, I mean, I was doing it during lockdown on season 3 earlier on in this year, And I would watch Liverpool games in that room because quite often we'd be there. Our lunch break is at 12. Mm. That's 8 p.m. UK time. So you'd be getting Champions League games. And I and one other member of staff were both big into Liverpool. And so we would quite often...
Would you get a two-hour lunch break to watch the whole
game? No, we'd watch as much as we could, basically. Mm. So we would usually get the first... We'd have an hour, so we get the first half and half time. And particularly, we were watching it a lot during Liverpool's run to the Madrid final in 2019. We watched the Barcelona home leg in there and lost our minds. And Rob was always lightly intrigued. He's a big sports fan, but very American about it. Mm. Like, it's boring. They just pass sideways. Nothing ever happens. They flop all the time, which, by the way, happens all the time in basketball. But for some reason, they're fixated on it happening in football.
But diving, flopping.
Diving. Right? They call it flopping. But yes, basketball is... It's rife there, but that's fine. But when we do it in football, it's unacceptable. Anyway, that's by the by. And when we went into lockdown, we all thought it was going to be 2 weeks. That was what we were talking, the LA kind of county health board was like, it's 2 weeks, then we'll go back to work. Mm. So we were all treating it that first 2 weeks. It's like, this is great. We've got 2 weeks paid holiday. Just got to stay at home. So we're all exchanging recommendations. You should watch this. You should listen to this. You should play this game. The show is based in a video game studio. So there was quite a lot of exchange of that. And I told Rob, look, you keep making fun of me for why I love football, but you don't understand the context, the like cultural DNA context of football for us. You should watch this thing Sunderland Till I Die. That will give you as good a primer in like what these teams mean to their communities and how it's very different to what being a Raiders fan is in the US. And the Raiders, currently the Las Vegas Raiders, they were the Oakland Raiders. They were the LA Raiders before that. They move around.
Sure.
Their fans sort of stay with them, but then sometimes just like, well, they're not in this town anymore, so I'll support this team.
Yeah.
They don't have that same, like, you get bitten by the bug and then it's sort of dreadful for the rest of your life thing that we do. And watching Sunderland Till I Die was kind of a perfect primer. And he texted me and was like, oh, yeah, watch the first episode. It's kind of all right. But Caitlin wasn't that into it, his wife. And like, you know, we're going to try something else. I was like, okay, I tried. And then he texted me 2 days later and said, oh, Caitlin's gone out of town. She'd gone up to check on her folks during this whole weird time. And I sat down, I watched the whole... both series in one sitting. He's like, I started on episode 2, couldn't stop. I just watched the whole lot all the way through. Mm. I cried, I laughed, I like jumped out of my seat, I did everything, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, great, you get it. It's job done. Anyway, that's enough of that. But then he was like, we should do this. We should buy a football team. And I was like, ha, 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 ha. That sounds great. You don't pay me enough, all the usual sort of good stuff. And he was like, no, seriously, like, how much would it cost to buy a football team? I was like, well, I don't know. Like, if you want to buy Chelsea, it's $1.5 billion, which I'm pretty confident you don't have. But if you go down, you know, as you go further down the pyramid, and the great thing about Sunderland Till I Die is that he'd seen promotion and relegation.
Yeah.
That was the thing he was fascinated by, because 95% of Americans have no concept of that,
sure.
Which is not a slight on them. It just doesn't exist in their sport. You know, there's a big thing over there of tanking your season. If you get halfway through the season, you're like, I guess we're not going to win. You intentionally lose because it gives you an advantage further down the line.
Yeah.
And the fact that you could be in a relegation battle and it would mean that every game mattered for all 38 games of a season or 46 in the National League or whatever it may be. He was just fascinated. So he said, we should buy a team. I was like, okay, great. I continued to think this was a lockdown, like, conversation that was just two friends sort of jabbering about something they weren't really going to do. But I was like, I've got nothing else to do. So I went on Wikipedia and Football Manager, literally, and was like, oh, okay, these Football Manager, as we know, is an incredible database of information that's actually quite hard to find elsewhere. And I picked out 8 to 10 clubs in the National League, National League North and South, and League Two.
Have you ever said what the other clubs were?
I think I've named some of them. So Hartlepool was one we looked at vaguely. Macclesfield was talked about. There were a couple that were talked about, you know, that were in trouble. We were like, we knew from the jump we wanted to find somewhere that sort of needed a helping hand or felt like it deserved a kind of a stroke of luck.
Yeah.
So some of the ones that I looked at initially, we struck off quite quickly because they were in the outskirts of London or Manchester or somewhere where you felt like, well, there's plenty of opportunity here already, in a way.
Smaller fish in a big pond, a bit.
Yeah, smaller fish in a big pond. I mean, Wrexham very quickly became top dog through a variety of factors, but the two biggest were the fans, which sounds like a very pat answer, but it's true, because the season before we became involved or started the process with a COVID shortened season 1920, they were averaging 4,500 a week at the race course when they were 19th in the National League.
Yeah,
it's an unbelievable number of people, and it told you this was the definition of a kind of sleeping giant a fallen great of the game. You know, the highest place they'd ever got to was then Division 2 in 1979-80, I think they got. They were promoted 78. It might be 78-79. Someone will correct me.
Those are the kind of details you have to get right now as the executive director of Wrexham.
Yes. But yes, in the late 70s, let's put it that way, they got to Division 2, but it was one season stay there. But, you know, they had been getting crowds of 35,000 back in those days. It was this great entity that had fallen from heights. They had great adventures in Europe. They'd beaten Porto in Europe. They'd done all sorts of exciting things via the Welsh Cup. That's how they would get in the Cup Winners' Cup. But now they had fallen on hard times. That was part one. Part two was of where they scored really highly on this kind of matrix was the geography. You've got the whole of North Wales that comes through us to go to Liverpool and Manchester to watch Premier League games. Yeah.
Well, so I was going to say, actually, sorry to interrupt you, but I went to secondary school in Colwyn Bay in North Wales, and I knew one person who was a Wrexham fan then, and I wonder, I mean, do you know, has that changed in the last
year? It's changed enormously, and my metric for measuring that is that so many folk there tell me, when I bump into them in the club car park or whatever it may be, that they, you know, they're taking their kids to play junior football now. And 2-3 years ago, it was all Manchester City and Liverpool tops.
Yeah.
It was all Salah shirts, De Bruyne shirts. And now they are all in Wrexham shirts. And I think that is a sign that they're, you know, people just wanted... They did an unbelievable job, the fans, of keeping the club alive. They rescued it from unscrupulous former owners and they supported it as best they could. But the club was on a slow decline and it was on its way down. We had this huge, wonderful, characterful old stadium, but there's a massive money pit. You know, it's a money pit for us, but we're fortunate we've got enough money that we can afford to patch the roof and fix the pipes and do all of this, that, and the other. But it's an old stadium, and that was creating a slow but steady decline in enthusiasm and, you know, smaller crowds coming each year, smaller budget each year. The team was performing less well each year. And I think, you know, well, when we took over and we started to look at the books, I think if we hadn't come in, I think relegation was on the cards, and I think possibly a winding up of the club or having to sell the stadium and redo a Phoenix football club situation. So that all those things were big factors that when we were looking for different teams, like, that's, you know, why Wrexham.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Okay. Was the it being based in Wales, maybe a cynical look at it, but to do with the branding, how it's easier to brand if you can attach it to that whole country,
well,
almost?
I mean, I did remember saying to Rob, because it was just Rob and I initially, and then Rob kind of went to Ryan to ask if he wanted to sponsor the team, and he was like, oh, I want to do the whole thing. So I remember saying to Rob initially, like, well, this effectively every game is a derby. Like, every game that we play has got an edge to it, because our fans just, you know, legitimately have beef with every team we play, some more than others, some like historical beefs, and they travel. I think our fans, 99% of our fans, travel incredibly well. They're very welcome everywhere they go. We've had trouble with elements, as a lot of clubs are finding post pandemic. There's been a kind of uptick in crowd problems, especially further down the leagues. But yeah, our fans travel in great numbers. They are vocal, they're positive, they have a lot of fun everywhere they go, but they travel very much with, like, we're Welsh and we're coming here to remind you of that, which is a great thing.
Let me ask you a question about you, because I think, like, when I watched through the documentary, for which you were a sort of consultant, right?
Yeah, so I don't actually... I have no, well, this is my line, but it's true. I have very little to say in what goes into the documentary, sure, as evidenced by episode, I think, 13, where they show part of me auditioning unsuccessfully for a Star Wars TV
show. It's one of the best bits.
It's mortifying, and I hate it. Luckily, there was more... Here's the degree of my effect.
Is that the
on
bit where you got worried about how fat you looked on camera?
Yes.
You kept doing it again because...
Yes. Yeah, yeah. I there's nothing... I couldn't do anything about it. I was like, I hope they want a fat alien. But they turns out they did not.
You don't get many fat aliens, do you?
No, but on the audition, on the breakdown, it was like, must be over 6'5". So it's like, it's got to be an alien, right? So I tried to be alien-y in my audition. And then when I watched it, I think Rupert Friend played the part that I was up for. And I was like, well, they just probably offered it to him anyway. I never was going to get this in the first place. But also, he was not particularly alien-y. He was just grey. He was a person who was grey. Yeah.
He's not the executive director of Wrexham.
But he's not the executive director of Wrexham.
And
so
let's be honest, which is the better role? Which brings me to ask you, you know, I think when people like or love football, when they're younger, they imagine being a football player. And then as they get older, they imagine maybe being a football coach. And then as they become wiser and realise their own limitations, the only thing left is like, maybe I could run a football club. You're sort of living out a dream. As someone who, I hope you won't mind me saying, didn't have any experience running a football club before you arrived.
No.
Is it weird? What's it like? Does it feel like...
One of the key things is, and I've said this a few times, I don't really run the football club. You know, much of my role is liaising between the owners and the people who do run the club on a day-to-day basis. So there are instances where, you know, I am, you know, decisions come to me to make, and I will make those decisions, and they get implemented or whatever it may be. But those, they tend to be very specific ones, and they're usually couched in kind of, you know, ultimately it has to be someone at my level. It has to be a board level person to make this decision. So yeah, I sit on the board with Robin Ryan, and I, you know, one of the main things that I do and can do is I can commit the club legally to things. So when we are, whether it's signing sponsorship deals or whether we are signing players or whatever it may be, I can commit the club to doing things. So yes, I have no experience. It has been a very steep learning curve. My job has been, I've been a comedy writer and an actor since I left university, and that has a very specific set of skills, not many of which are applicable in football or the running of a football club.
Some.
But I mean, a lot of it is just, I have loved football my whole life. I think I have an understanding of what is important to fans and what they want and what they care about. And my job is to kind of, as much as possible, and it doesn't require a great deal of steering for me, but steer Robin Ryan in the directions that I think will be popular. You know, there are things that they want to do sometimes. I'm like, oh, you know, just culturally over here, I don't know that that would go down so well. And there are other things where I'm like, yeah, and by the way, there've been a couple of those where I've been like, ooh, I'm not sure. And then they've been like, no, we want to do it. And then people love it. So I'm like, oh, what do I know? I'm an idiot.
Was there a point when you were sketching out the concept for Rob, was there a point for you where you suddenly thought, I mean, because it sounds like you had an amazing job at the time. Was there a point which you thought, oh God, I want this. I'm a football fan. This would be so cool. Even without kind of a designated role.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes, just to be part of it at all. I mean, the thing that I think I'm absolutely sure all three of you will get what I'm meaning here. Like the moment when I was like, I think there's going to be an opportunity here for me to enter a football stadium wearing a club badge and for it to be a real thing. And for it to be like, oh, this, yes, I am part of this. Mm. And not just because I bought a replica shirt from the club shop. You know, I am a Liverpool fan by night now. As you can hear from my thick Bootle accent, I'm nowhere near Liverpool. I've got nothing to do with it.
And how tired you are, being up all night supporting Liverpool.
Yes.
That's a long shift. Yeah.
I was the definition of a full kit wanker. Like, I love, always had all the gear, no idea. I loved it. Every Christmas, all I wanted was Liverpool stuff. And I'd been to Anfield too many times to count. And I love it. And I've always felt very welcome there. I've always felt part of it. But always with a slight air of like, no one's going to miss me if I'm not here. And I'm not really, you know, I haven't done anything to forward the cause.
You're not vital to the operation.
I'm not. No one. Yes, they don't. When Mohamed Salah scores, he doesn't pick me out of the crowd and thump his chest and I give him a thumbs up.
You don't know that because you don't know who he's pointing at.
That's true. I mean, I'm always like trying to position myself like, am I in the angle of his point?
But I wonder if he's watched the Welcome to Wrexham. I bet loads of footballers have watched it.
I mean, that is too exciting to even contemplate.
It's fun, isn't it?
I mean, the thing I'm most excited about, well, I'll tell you two things. One thing that's really weird is, and this is something that I've found talking to a lot of people inside football, you never lose your love for that other club, but your focus, so much of my energy is going into Wrexham now that now I find myself in situations where I literally be like, oh, Liverpool are playing, aren't they? They're like on right now. I wonder what the score is, which I never could have conceived of 2 years ago. It was such a like, my week was so geared around like, okay, all right, just got to get through these next 2 days and then there's a Champions League game or whatever.
And do like Wrexham defeats now affect you in the same way that Liverpool won?
So much worse than it was then. Because I was always quite good. I love football. I was quite good at getting the high and avoiding the low about football. I was always quite sort of good at going, you know, oh yes, this was great. But like, oh, well, you know, what are you going to do? We lost. That sucks. And I get over it quite quickly. Wrexham is a whole different thing because it's so... I have another job. I'm acting on a TV show in the States right now. I'm on hiatus for the next 2 weeks, which is why I'm here, but I'm going back until January. But whilst I am there, I mean, I am just all the time, I'm on my phone checking like my emails and doing this, that, and the other, and just trying to keep abreast of things, waiting for, you know, every Friday night, our head of our medical staff sends an email with like what the current state of all the players are, like what their medical situation is. And I'm like, you know, oh, it's kind of, Kev's email's coming.
That's
in,
a milestone
like,
in a week it. For you.
Yeah, because it's, you know, it's that thing of, you know, you have players that are injured and you're like, God, I can't wait until they get back. And you truly have that thing where, you know, get an email that's like, oh, someone's progressing faster than we thought, so we think we're going to have them back 2 games earlier. And then other things like, there's been a setback with this guy. And it just means so much more to me than reading on Twitter a thing in Liverpool Echo being like, oh, we're hearing that Fabinho's hamstring's still tight.
It sounds like Football Manager when you start getting
emails. I was also going to say, like, listening to you talk about it, the documentary is brilliant, by the way. I think, like, we were saying before we started recording, I think, like, for the three of us here, you know, we got through the first couple of episodes where it feels much more like a normal sports documentary, but then it turns into something which, like, you can see has been written by people who understand structure. And there's a moment in it towards the end when Wrexham are in the FA Trophy semi-final. Ryan Reynolds has gone to the game, and the episode is quite funny because Rob McElhenney is at home, is upset to have been left behind. It's all done very well. But the thing I think, you know, amongst other things that sets it apart from other sports documentaries of the kind, is that I've never seen somebody catch the bug before. In that moment, you see Ryan Reynolds, he appears to be enjoying it beforehand. He's up for, you know, no suggestion that it's a cynical thing on his behalf. But it's not until that moment where you literally watch him on camera click. And it's like, it's actually moving to see it.
I don't know. No, I mean, you're exactly right. And that was an amazing thing to be aware of. I wasn't there for that game. I was back in the States. So I was following from home. And Sean Harvey, who's the strategic advisor to the board, who is our man on the ground, who is kind of been so central to everything we've done, he was there, and he and I, there's a group thread with all of us on it, with Rob and Ryan and Sean and I on, that we, you know, talk business and updates and all sorts of things.
Memes.
And then he and I have like separate, lots of loads of hilarious memes. And then we have a separate, Sean and I have a separate thing because we're just talking so much more. And we don't want to clog that up. And he sent me a message in this separate one being like, Ryan's crying in the corner at full time. And I was like, what? And he's like, I don't know what's happened, but he's got it. He got it, and he got it bad. Yeah. And it's true, because I think up until that point, he'd been into the whole thing and he'd seen the excitement of the whole thing, but his interest, and I will say Rob has gone through a similar transformation, albeit his was earlier and a bit faster. They saw the whole thing initially as a giant philanthropic engine. Yeah. That's what they're excited about, was one of the reasons we picked Wrexham. It was a town, you know, like many in the UK, that's been sort of left behind a little bit over the last 20 years. They had a big coal industry, big steel industry, big brewing. It all went away. And there was just a sense of like, this is a place that could just use a stroke of luck. It could use something good happening. So Ryan's interest to start off with was like, well, what if we build up this football club thing, that'll be good for the town, and then we can do other things to like do good things for this town. And then over the course of the season, he came to the Maidenhead game, he came to Torquay, and both of those were pretty disappointing results. And he was like, this is great. It's cool. It's fun. It's like, I like this a lot. But that game with a 91st minute winner, effectively, followed by a 94th minute sort of certainty-er.
Yes.
Assurer. He just lost it. And you see, they've got the footage, there's fan footage of him in the, he's standing in the thing with him, like with his hands on his head. He just couldn't believe it, because it was a great goal. Yeah. And it was against our big rivals in the league at that time, Stockport, who are traditionally a rival of Wrexham's anyway, but who we were kind of trying to track down in the league. And that game, that was the point where we started to believe, oh, we might just pip them to the post in the league.
Mm.
Spoiler alert, didn't go that way. But it was like that. I remember at home, that moment when I heard the goal go in I was listening to it on our like club commentary, and like losing my mind, and then getting this message from Sean being like, Ryan is sobbing. And then you see on the documentary him going around like just embracing players and staff, and like it just was a whole, that was the moment. And from that moment on, there was a marked change in how he kind of approached the whole thing. He had always been interested and abreast of everything, but he was a lot more like just proactive and wanted to know about all the details and so much more. He'd always been very that way on okay, we're doing this community scheme, we're doing that, we're setting this thing up, we're doing X, Y, and Z. But he suddenly started to be very like, what are we going to do about Maidenhead's approach to their wingback system on Saturday? I don't know, I'll find out and let you know.
Yeah, right?
it just became, and I'm so pleased because that's the thing that happened to me, the first time I went to a professional football match and was like, whoa, this is incredible.
That's what it's all about.
Yeah.
That's literally the whole point, isn't it? Yeah. So it's like, it's lovely to see that on camera.
Yeah. Were there moments for you which were quite intimidating? There's a scene quite early on where you meet the players for the first time.
And I love thinking, that bit.
Me too, because it's like, you don't...
Can we say when Humphrey leaves the room, the door closes slowly and there's a little giggle, a little titter from the room.
Certainly is, yeah.
Because you sound like me.
Yeah.
And you're out of your element and you're in a situation which presumably comes with, in the beginning, plenty of cynicism.
Yeah.
Was that kind of, for you, was that quite tricky?
It was. I mean, it was and it wasn't. I mean, I think the fact that I was just so excited, as I say, and again, I think talking to the right sort of three people about it, because I know that all of you, I think, would feel very similar. You're like, well, this is an opportunity I never dreamt I would get. I never even thought... You know, you describe that kind of the course you go through. In a court, I had the same thing. I was like, I would like to score a winner for England in the World Cup final. And I would like to do, I'm sure JJ has a very similar with England.
I would like to
England,
score the winner against England.
Against England, yeah. Ideally, it would be England. Yes, yeah, yeah. Just Ryan Christie just dropping one on your head at the back post.
Anyone, truly
anyone. But yes, the you know, I did go through that process. And at a certain point was like, of course you're not. You're never going to work in football. You've got no appropriate skills. At a certain point in life, I feel like you get locked into I'm going to work in entertainment in some way, shape, or form. I've not got the skills for
anything
else.
What a drag.
No, I mean, and I'm insanely lucky because I work. Sure. I have two of my three dream jobs I am doing at the moment. I'm acting on a TV show. I'm the executive director of a football club. I will never be a fighter pilot, which is the other one that I wanted to be when I was little. But I was never that little. And I knew pretty early on that I was too tall to be. Yes.
Sure.
Oh, well, not that. I just literally wouldn't fit in the cockpit of a fighter plane. Sure, yeah. Right. I remember going to the Royal Tournament when I was a kid and they had a Spitfire there. And they put me into it. And I was probably 12. And they were like... No,
unless
mate.
You stop growing that.
Yeah, they were like, already you're too tall.
What's the Royal Tournament? Is that a big playing
show? It was
show?
A big thing they used to do at Earl's Court every year that was like a sort of, a bit like the Edinburgh Tattoo. It was like a tattoo thing.
Right.
It was great fun.
The fire carriage.
I've been to it once. I went to it once with my mum and dad. Yeah. All I remember is horses.
Yeah, lots of horses. They would do this thing called the gun race where they would like carry, there was a Navy thing where they like take apart like a gun, a big cannon, and like carry it from one side of the thing to the other. It was like a racy thing.
Right. Yes. You shot it first, you won.
It was like a big tradition.
A weird military circus.
That's a very good description of it. Yeah. And it was also like heavily designed to like try and get 12-year-old boys to be like, I want to be in the army. So when they grow up, they join the army. And it worked on me great.
Sure.
until I discovered I couldn't fit in an airplane.
You were too large.
They were like, no. And I also read Roald Dahl's autobiography, Going Solo, which talks about him flying Hurricanes in Malta during World War II, where he was 6'3" and he couldn't turn as hard as anybody else because it would bang his knees. And I was like, you'll die. How did you not die? Anyway, by the by. So you have all these wonderful opportunities. So although I knew going into it that I would be quite, you know, it was like, it was a deep breath. I mean, I remember they have that thing of me like riding up on my bicycle and I would bike into the stadium every day because I was staying about 2 miles away from the stadium. And I was like, this would be good for me. But every time I was going in, I was a little bit like, okay, let's see what today brings. And actually, everyone was incredibly welcoming.
Yeah.
I think I didn't blame the players at all for being, this is very weird, or Dean for being, this is very weird, because it was weird.
It was funny.
Of course, it's like this big, who is this big Wally? And I, in my wisdom, was like, I shouldn't really be here. Well, like trying to be self-deprecating.
You're self-effacing and you're,
I know.
You're kind of charming in a sort of whoopsie-daisy kind
but
of way.
But what I should really have done is try to... Thank you. I'll take it.
No, that's a compliment.
I am the sort of Hill.
You'd be coming in your fighter pilot uniform.
Yes, what I should have done is I should have played a part. I should have sort of kicked the door in and be like, what's up, everybody?
I was going to say, is it not quite performative? Because it's like a performance, right? You know it's going to be nervous talking in front of these boys. It's like
I feel like that in front of them.
Well, but I think I described it, and it was... they used my description of it in the documentary, which was it really was like being back at school, and suddenly you were with like all the cool kids from like the first 11, the top football boys, and I was the guy that was spent a lot of time pretending to be a dinosaur, and I suddenly had to be like, I'm in charge, you're going to listen to me.
I felt that very
keenly. Sounds very familiar. Yes. Yeah.
I really did.
Oh, no, sure.
Because even though, you know, in the, your position within the club, theoretically, if we're talking hierarchically, you have a very senior position.
Oh,
you know,
for
you're
sure.
Alongside the owners, but you walk into that room with all the football players.
Yes.
And you presumably feel like a little boy.
Totally. And if I approach my role in a different way, I could be very didactic. I mean, I have the authority, theoretically, to do all sorts of things.
What kind of things?
Oh, just, well, let's see this season's team.
Yeah.
If any of you are listening, just behave. No, but very early on, I established with both with Dean and that set of players, and then with when Phil came in, everybody else, I said, look, I'm not going to tell you ever how to do your jobs. I don't know how to do your jobs. I have theories and opinions, but they're no better than anyone else's. Yeah. You know, you see time and again when people come in and take over football clubs, they're like, listen, I'm very good at business. I did this and I made a load of money. And as a result, I know everything about how you do everything. And you get disastrous results. Yeah. That happens quite often. And one of the things that I think Rob and Ryan have been very sensible about, and that I will say I'm going to pat myself on the back about, is that we've always gone, we don't know how to do this. All we'll do is try and give you guys the tools to do the things that you need. So if you need something, come to us and then, you know, tell me, and then I'll tell them, and I'll try and explain to them why you want this thing and what the benefits of it is. And by the way, in the main, they're just like, well, if, you know, Phil's asked for it, then just give it to him.
Yeah.
Like if they want this and they want that. I mean, you know, the only place that gets a certain point is we set a budget and you get towards the end of a transfer window and it's like, oh, if we could just get one, if we just get this guy, then we'll do X and Y. And then you have to have that debate. But you know, we've backed them very, very fully. And, you know, we're reaping the benefits now because we're currently second in the National League by 1 point and we're flying, scored an insane amount of goals.
Yeah.
So, we're pretty confident we'll get
where we need to. That's what they say in the documentary. Mm. I mean, one of the things they say towards the end is that whilst you arrived not knowing much about what you were going to do, they now say that, you know, you could be like a top football executive, or that, like,
incredibly
they talk about
generous.
Your
I think they're trying to offload me to another team as quickly as possible.
Oh, he's really
desperately
good.
Hoping, like, Blackburn Rovers, do you want him? He's great.
When this began, did you think that your role in it might be a kind of, you know, the middleman between, you know, the beginning and the end? Did you think that you would be there forever, or are you thinking now that you will have a role as long as they do?
I'm hoping so. I mean, I my wife and my family all live in Los Angeles, and I spend about half the year here, and she can come sporadically, but she's much more successful than I am in her field, which she's also a TV writer, but like a way better one than me. And so, you know, we've always said between her and I, and she works with Rob as well, so that everyone, it's all a kind of big family thing, you know, that at some stage, we know we need to keep an eye on that because it's a challenge. It's a lot of traveling. I spend a lot of time on my own in my little flat in Wrexham. And that is, you know, it's not necessarily something that is going to go forever. I mean, I think in terms of my transformation, I mean, they are being very generous in terms of me being a top football executive. That's not true. What I am is I'm very passionate and I love the club and I love the players and I love the fans and I have a very good relationship with the fans because I think in talking to me, they realize that I love it. And I get one of the things that is such a blessing about this, I would have loved to work for a football team irrespective of what the football team was or who the owners were, but working for two people, and this is real saccharine, you can edit this out if there's two great if people are being sick in their cars, this is this, they're two people who are good people, they want the best for the team in the town, which comes through in the documentary, which is produced by a production company they picked or whatever, but it makes it a lot easier when we're not here to make a load of money and we're not here to kind of, you know, talking to Sean, who's worked for lots of people over the years, you know, he loves working for Wrexham because for a long time he worked for various people who were like, yeah, I mean, I know I said I was going to put 10 million into the transfer budget this winter, but I'm not doing that. And actually, I'd love you to get 2 million out of the club by Christmas, please. Mm-hmm. And he is executive or chief executive or whatever role he had at various different places had to be like, all right, you know, it's part of my job is to go out and sell that to the fans as like not being the end of the world. And for us, it's just a pleasure. So for me, I think what I have brought to the team is just I'm really enjoying myself and I'm positive. And I've got the nice thing that I'm, so far, the fans have allowed me to sporadically scold them when they get too upset about things I don't think they should be too upset about. And I can say with truth, like, I'm a fan. I'm basically have the same views as you guys do.
Yeah.
But all I'll say is, like, transfer window's not closed yet. We're working on target. So, you know, last January, we had a thing where we knew going into the January transfer window what we needed to get kind of a more complete team.
Yeah.
And you see that in the documentary, particularly it was Ollie Palmer, basically, like, we need a big, strong, mobile centre forward yeah. who can hold the ball up and bring Paul into play.
And you were injured.
And I was, I was like, Phil, just give me a go. And he was like, absolutely not. Can you touch your toes? I was like, no. It's like, okay, you're out. You're cut. Yeah.
Is that really? Oh man. I would never get anywhere near.
You got to be able to touch your toes. I haven't touched
my feet for years.
Well, yeah. I'm recently finding it hard to see them when I stand up straight, which is also a bad sign. Yes, no, I mean, we knew who we wanted, and it took us the whole of the transfer window because Wimbledon didn't want to sell him. He didn't really want to come initially because he's from Wimbledon. Mm. He was like, it's all going well for me. I don't know. I'm not sure. And so we had to go through the motions. But when you're a fan, you don't hear you don't know what's going on. You don't understand the ins and outs of it. You don't have all these things. And so you are, understandably, because you want the best fit for the team, you start to panic. You're like, what's going on? What's happening?
Yeah.
So I think one of the things that has grown up that's nice is that, like, I think people know that we're in some ways a lot more blunt than many football organizations. Like I write a column on the website and I tweet and I'll just be like, it's fine, chill out. And people are like, oh, okay, I guess it's all right. And then, you know, fortunately that works provided we end up signing Ollie before the end of the window, which at times was looking a bit hairy and we were like, got to look at other strikers. But, you know, people have put a lot of trust in us, which is great. And we've, you know, I think thus far done a pretty good job of repaying that trust.
Yeah.
You know, we tend to do what we say we're going to do. We've invested a lot in the stadium. We've invested a lot in the squad. We've tried to, you know, there are restrictions of things that we can do because of how old the stadium is and how, you know, we're getting 10,000 people a week now. Our food and beverage offering is bad because we've got two tiny concrete kiosks that are used to serving 4,000 people.
Yeah.
So we're always like, I'm sorry, you know, people are kind of, well, I can't get a sausage roll. It's like, well, yeah, we've run out of them and the cooker doesn't work
and there's not
all these sort of things. So yeah, it's you know, because we're also getting a lot of people back in who have been going to Premier League stadiums for the last 10 years
and
so used to amazing, like, they've got nachos at Burnley. Where are your nachos?
Yeah. I prefer it without the nachos. It's better with just a pie.
But I will say to people, to be fair, Erics fans would be like, well, I'd take a pie if you had a pie, but we can't. We run out of pies too quickly. We're running out of pies and running out of beer on match days regularly, and people are like, boo!
Can I ask then, do you ever get frustrated? Because I remember speaking to Steve Morrison, ex-footballer, who's a coach now, on this podcast, and the one thing that he said that stuck with me for ages was that if his coach has asked him not to press as a forward, but the crowd are shouting, close him down.
Yes.
You either do it and the coach is unhappy with you, or you don't do it and the crowd think you're doing something wrong. In your position, presumably it does happen that fans don't like what you're doing.
Oh, definitely. And this is not to paint a picture that, like, we've got absolutely everything right and they're happy about everything. You know, we've had to do things like, we put ticket prices up, which people were very unhappy about, but we hadn't done that since 2006. And we made it £1 extra a game, which we're like, I don't know how we could do a smaller price increase. But what they will say, which is quite right, is that the knock-on effect to season tickets was some season tickets went up by £100.
Yeah.
And people aren't super duper happy about that. But at the same time, it's sort of what I would say is we have a responsibility to the football club to run it as efficiently and appropriately as we possibly can. So having been fan-owned for a long time, there were lots of things that were great for fans, but bad for the football club.
Yeah.
So we had to take certain steps. Another thing, we had the Centenary Club, which is our sort of our bar in the Yale stand, our oldest stand, or the Wrexham Lager stand as it is right now. That was traditionally teeming on a match day. It's one of the very few indoor spaces in the stadium, but it had so many people in it that when we got in and we were like, what's the license, how many people are allowed in here, we discovered it was two or three times over the capacity.
Sure.
And previously I think the council and local authorities and stuff had kind of looked the other way because they were like, this club is, it's heartbeat of the community, it's trouble, lots of them are fans, you know, so they didn't want to kick up a fuss. But with the increased attention on us, now we're like, we got to play by the rules.
Yeah.
Because we, you know, with that increased attention comes extra attention from people who don't necessarily have the club's best interest in heart. So what we ended up doing was saying, okay, if you want to come in here, you can buy a pass to come in the Centenary Club or pay £5 a game to come in. And it really was mostly people like, you know, you're going to make way less money than you used to. And like, well, it's not actually about that. It's more about, we have to be responsible for things that previously maybe people brushed under the carpet or didn't want to address or didn't want to, you know, think about.
Is it easier to do that kind of thing because of the fame of Rob and Ryan? Just because in that situation, like...
What do you mean, like, do the council listen?
No, I just mean in selling it to fans, because what can Ryan Reynolds materially benefit from
Yeah.
Wrexham, because it's so sort of unimaginably successful already. And Rob McElhenney, of course, is really successful in his own way too. And so there's no obvious agenda beyond we're doing the right thing. Does that make it
easier to sell? Yeah. Definitely. I think that people have given us a lot more leeway because of that. Because yes, as you say, and they say this themselves in the documentary, like they're not sort of shady foreign businessmen who can disappear back into a sort of rabbit hole if things go wrong. People recognize that if they catastrophically messed up here, it would carry them around. Alex Hamilton was the guy who basically tried to kind of essentially run the club down so he could sell the stadium for a large amount of money because it's right in the middle of Wrexham. It's prime real estate. It would be a very valuable asset. And so, yes, I think we benefited from that for sure. And it has allowed us to say, you know, and I see Wrexham fans talking to each other about this themselves online. You know, when there are those instances of, you know, there are certain elements of the fan base who still understand and are totally fair enough. That's their entire opinion, are not into it. They liked the philosophy of a fan-owned club. They liked being part of that. They liked being part of the process. It was the boundary between club and fans was non-existent at that stage. There wasn't a delineation. The fans were the club was the fans. Mm. And now there is a bit. There's a lot of us newcomers that have come in who aren't necessarily from the area, but who are trying to run the football club for the benefit of the fans. But equally, they don't have that same access. You know, it used to be that like as soon as we made a bid on a player, every Wrexham fan knew because it was, you know, the people doing the bidding would literally go down the pub and be like, "Oh, we've tried to sign this guy from Maidenhead." It's exciting, isn't it? And it'd be great fun. And listen, that's one way of doing it.
It's cool.
It's really cool. I understand.
I'd love to meet that guy in the pub.
Yes.
I know all the clubs.
Of course. And everyone knew it. And there was a lot of gossip. And now, you know, now we are, there is a bit more of a barrier. And that does create its own challenges because people think, you know, people still go down the pub and tell things, but it's not necessarily what's actually going on.
Sure.
And I see all sorts of wild things. I mean, you know, a lot of it is like what we're paying people. There's this, every now and then, myself and Sean and Fleur Robinson, our CEO, and like various different people will text each other being like, "I've just seen we're paying this person £13,000 a week." You know, so every time you find one that trumps the top number, which is currently stands at £13,000 a week, which is a championship / young premiership player.
Yeah.
We are not paying anywhere close to that for anyone. You know, we laugh, but it, you know, time was that people's wages were being discussed in the pub. People were being told X, Y, and Z. And
specifically for you,
I'm getting paid a lot of money. If that's
you're the one being paid £13,000 a week.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you know, you were a successful and noteworthy person before this, right? And I'm sure that people would recognize you or come up to you or you know would seek you out. But that kind of recognition is very different from the kind that you would have now, not purely because of the volume, but because now presumably people who recognize you in Wrexham, you have information they want. Like they want to know something that you know, as opposed to just wanting to meet you. How do you feel about your status
in Wrexham? People have been so, genuinely so welcoming to me. Like from the moment I kind of got there, even when people, you know, it's interesting. I've not been there very much. In fact, I'm going up tomorrow. It's the first time I've been there since the documentary came out. Right. So I think lots of kind of, The hardcore fan base who are obsessed with all things Wrexham know who I am. They have been so friendly, so nice. Every now and then I get stopped in London or actually in Chicago on the way here. I was stopped by two people. They were documentary fans rather than like Wrexham fans per se. But everybody in Wrexham has been so welcoming to us that and all the new kind of additions to the family. Which again, I was quite not surprised about, not because of Rex, not because of anything, but for me specifically, as we talked about before, me being a public school boy, not being an experienced football person, I think lots of people were initially. I mean, when my involvement was first kind of announced, I would go and sort of snoop around our fan forums and stuff, and would see lots of people being like,
"Never read the comments,
this guy." Yeah. You know, sure. Yeah. I mean, unfortunately, it's like I often describe it as like when a tooth falls out, you can't help sort of sticking your tongue in the hole, sometimes going and looking at what people sound like. But as I say, people have been 99.99999% of people have been so welcoming and kind and friendly, and I think it's because as I alluded to earlier, they can sense that we are into it. I mean, I think one of the biggest things that is you know they can say about me is I'm not putting out the money, I'm not doing the this, I'm not doing the that. Rob and Ryan quite rightly have sort of achieved a sort of godlike status in Wrexham because they have saved this beloved thing from you know, a pretty dangerous path it was on, which was no one's fault. It was just circumstance had set it on this course that was very difficult to correct without bringing in a lot of outside investment. But what people I think have got from me is that, like, I left work late on Thursday night in LA, and I went home, went to bed. I got home at about 9 o'clock at night after leaving work, quickly stuffed some things in a suitcase, got up at 6:30, went to the airport, flew Los Angeles to Chicago, Chicago to London, London to Newcastle to try and get up there to watch our fourth round FA Cup qualifier. And if you take out the fact that the climate change and I flew in an airplane, which I probably shouldn't have done, I think people appreciate that we are busting our humps to get to games and sure. get to watch things and do these things. And I was sort of tweeting during the whole thing, one of my flights got delayed and I had to leave my luggage at Heathrow and I had to go and get on a train to get up to Newcastle.
You've come here without a suitcase today.
I've come here without a suitcase.
Because you're a dedicated Wrexham supporter.
As I said, I had to buy a jumper off a street vendor to come here. I went to Uniqlo, I got some underpants. The guy had a stall on the street.
But it makes it sound like you were half naked before you got to
I went to the street vendor wearing my very smelly and disgusting clothes that I'd been wearing for 2.5 days.
They'll sell you anything if you walk up to them just in your pants.
He was like, please just put this on and go away.
Just take it.
Do you think that the lovely welcome that you've gotten and the other guys have had at Wrexham, a lot of that, would that happen without the documentary? Because it kind of goes hand in hand.
I think it would have done because, you know, as I say, it was happening long before the documentary came out. I haven't seen anyone at the club since the documentary came out, really. I've spoken to people on the phone and I've been emailing and Zooming and all that kind of stuff. But I'm going to be interested to see whether my experience changes, whether more of the fans recognize me or more fans feel like they, you know, people who maybe have seen me in the car park and been like, oh, that's that bloke, you know, now will be like, oh, hello, I know, you know, I feel like I know you. Or whatever. Mm. So I'd be interested to see, and I look forward to discovering. I think, again, we did various things, Rob and Ryan in particular, like were behind various things we did at the start, which I think were very clever. That just said, look, we did things like, you know, we paid all our players have been furloughed, all our staff have been furloughed. We came and we're like, we'll pay you the money that you would have been paid last year, as a kind of welcome. It was like 60 grand, something like that, and it was like, just have what you would have had because you've served this club for a long time during a difficult period, and we want to reflect that. And I think lots of people are like, oh, okay, we didn't need to do that. That's fair enough. And we invested in infrastructure, stuff that doesn't really benefit the football club per se, but it improves the fan experience. We redid the tech end, as it was then, it still is now. Actually, currently doesn't have a sponsor. If anyone's listening, wants to sponsor the tech or university end of the ground. We went in and kind of redid the concourse in there, which hadn't changed since it was built in the 70s and was dark and dingy and kind of terrible. And various things, we were just like, look, we're not just baffing money on the first team. We're not looking to like just pump and dump this football club, like take it up. We're trying to do things in a more holistic fashion. And I think all those things people appreciated and were nice and kind and friendly. So it's been great. I mean, the one thing I said...
It comes across like loud and clear on the documentary. Really,
yeah, and you know, it's been super rewarding. The single best thing about it for me is just... It the two things. One, walking into the stadium with a badge on. That's a very selfish little thing that I just get such a kick out of every time I get to do it. And the other one is those instances where usually before a game, and if you're listening to this, kids, don't do this. I go and sort of smoke cigarettes furiously outside the office and chat to people that are coming in. And what will happen is kind of virtually every game, someone will come up to me and say, I came to Wrexham for 50 years. I was a season ticket holder for 50 years. And I just couldn't, I stopped about 8 years ago. I just couldn't bear seeing this thing I love just slowly die in front of me. So I stopped. I did other things. But then I came to my first game, like tentatively about 3 weeks ago with my grandson, and I loved it, and I'm back, and I'm going to buy a season ticket next season, and I've bought the shirt. And people literally come and they sort of tears in their eyes, give me a hug. You know, that is that's the single best thing about the whole thing. Because I never get that anywhere else. It is, and it's to be part
few
of it.
Years, it like it is actually yeah. and it's nice for you to be part of it. Yeah.
It's wonderful. I will say one final thing on that, which is the first time I Zoomed with Ryan along with Rob, I did say to him, there will come a time when we draw three games in a row in the championship in like 2029, and someone will call you the C word in an airport in front of your children because they're a Wrexham fan. They're a new Wrexham fan.
Yes.
Who's not an old one, doesn't remember the bad times, who's, you know, is like a, what I think people sometimes refer to as FIFA football fans, sure. If you know what I mean. The people who are like, oh yeah, I'm a Liverpool fan now because they're going to buy Mbappe, and then when they don't buy Mbappe, they're like, I hate Jurgen Klopp and I hate FSG. And I was like, that will probably happen, but for now, you know, that's we being a victim of your success.
Sure.
I'm sure we would take that. We'll accept that if it means we're in the championship and we're in a good place.
You have to go in a moment, so I'm just going to ask you a series of very quick questions,
please,
if that's okay. And these are all hypothetical.
I
you can
it.
dream large, if you will. The first one would be the dream signing, excluding regens, so we can't really go that far into the future. But hypothetically, Wrexham do extremely well over the next 6 years.
Yeah.
Who's the dream? Doesn't
Who's
have to be that realistic signing.
Well, I think it would be trying to bring back... I tell you who it is. Nico Williams.
Okay, yeah.
He's from the area.
Sure.
He's someone... He's like a perfect example of someone who... I think he was on Wrexham's radar at one stage, but very quickly was gone into a Premier League academy.
Mm.
And I would love to get... I think if we were signing Nico... Okay, I mean, this is going really bold. If we're signing Nico Williams when he's like 29, that would be the sign we've gone somewhere mad. Because we're signing a full Welsh international who's from the area, Premier League player. That's... I'm quite pleased with that answer.
It feels like really good. Did you know that Nico Williams listens to this podcast?
I didn't. Nico.
We birthed the transfer rumor. Just
news.
And I plucked him. Also, he used to play at Liverpool, which is also nice. Then I'd be like, what's a younger club like?
A little bit. And listen, you know, Coach Phil, lovely.
Yeah. Great.
We don't want to replace him.
Of course
but
not.
If we were replacing him, who's the dream coach?
Well,
you can't say Klopp.
No, of course not. Well, I'm trying to look into the future because I'm hoping that Phil's going to build a dynasty here.
Yes.
So he can retire having coached 10,000 games.
It's a lovely scene, actually, when he's having his pre-match breakfast with his son.
Yes.
That's
cool.
Yeah, he's still in the local community.
I think the documentary has been so good for his relationship with the fans because there's that classic thing of like, again, because there's this slight barrier that we've built that they're not necessarily used to, and they were very kind of communicative with previous managers. I think lots of the fans were like just not sure about him, didn't know that much about him, hadn't seen any side to him. They just saw post-match interviews, which, as we all know, everyone is very robotic and very like that's the job. Part of the job is you saying, yeah, well, you know, we didn't do the things we were supposed to do very well, and we did some things well, and you know, you don't get that much. So I think watching it, they have really taken him to heart since then. But my dream would be going along a similar path. I mean, Steve Cooper is, again, someone who's head of youth at Wrexham at one stage before he went to Swansea. So be another case of bringing someone back who is from the area, knows the club. I mean, like Joe Allen, I suppose, if Joe Allen turned out to be a great... I'm thinking about like current players.
Sure.
Who played for Liverpool and Wrexham, more importantly, and Wrexham and Old Welsh. Lots of those things.
Yeah.
Otherwise, I would love just like a wild, flamboyant sort of South American.
Marcelo Bielsa.
Yes, someone like that.
I mean, Marcelo Bielsa at Wrexham would be amazing.
That would be wild.
It would be very exciting. Yeah. But of course, but Marcelo Bielsa's a bit too. This is why I'm trying to pick current players because this needs to be a good 10 to 15 years in the future.
He'll be around still. He's not going to be around.
He will,
Two more very quickly.
Yeah.
Three words, please, to describe your current sort of emotional state as it relates to Wrexham. Very odd question, but...
Oh, three words. Okay, they don't need to be connected, really, do they?
No, not to each other.
Buoyant.
Buoyant, okay, yeah.
Tentative, because...
they're very much not connected.
No, well, that's what I said, they don't have to be connected, right? Well, no, only because, I mean, as I said earlier, the energy that I put into it, I get so stressed. I find it quite hard watching the games.
Yes.
I mean, last year... When I came back, we went on a run. We won something like 13 games in this incredible sort of period after Ollie arrived in January. We went on a kind of a tear. And I came back into the stadium for our game against Eastleigh. And it was 2-2 in the 96th minute. It was the first game that I had been to since this run began. And I was like, oh, Jonah, I've jinxed it. I've ruined it. And we got a penalty. And Paul was going to take it. Paul Mullins dynamite at penalties. But I left. I left the stands and went down and like hid sort of under the stairs.
Yeah.
And David, who runs the boardroom, sort of is like, what's going on? Are you all right? And I was like, I can't do it. He's like, I thought we just scored. I was like, no, it's just a penalty. Because he heard the roar. He didn't know what... was happening. And I sort of went and like paced on the stairs furiously and then heard another roar and was like, oh my God, thank God. But I find it very stressful. Yeah. So I'm saying tentative because...
Your tentative buoyancy, yeah.
Yeah, we've started brilliantly. We've scored, as I say, a hatload of goals. Mm. Notts County have also started really well. It's a very long season. It's a really difficult league to get out of. Sure. I mean, last year, us and Stockport were comfortably the best teams. And we faltered in the playoff semi-final. We had some key injuries. You just can't control... I mean, we've got a lot of factors in our favour this year.
Sure.
We got rid of our... We had transfer windows, which no one else in our division did. Yeah. And we managed to get those kind of taken away.
Yeah.
So we can now sign players outside of a transfer window. So if we get a really bad injury in February, it doesn't screw us as badly. But yes, buoyant, tentative, and grateful, I suppose.
Grateful.
Because it's, to be doing this at all remains... insane and so exciting and fun.
Last question. You have an exposure now to the inside of the, you know, the inner workings of a football club, and hopefully, you know, at a higher level as Wrexham become more and more successful. Surely as a writer and as a comic, there is like invaluable material there.
Sure.
Are you already thinking that maybe you've got something in you? Could you write a sitcom or something about
there? I mean, there is enough stuff to fill a sitcom like on a weekly basis, really, in terms of things that go on. No question. I mean, I think at the moment it's something that I kind of loosely, when my agent and manager and stuff back home are always like, yeah, you're gonna do it. Why don't you do a TV show about it?
Putting their fingers together.
There's a lot of steepled fingers and like
15%
thought bubbles.
The eyeballs
with swimming
are
pools.
Dollar signs.
Yes. Ding, 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 ding. But I mean, at the moment, I'm very much, it's such a boring politic answer, but I'm very much concentrating on like just doing the job at the moment.
You're doing the post-match interview thing right now.
Yeah, I am. Listen, in some area, you know, we've done, we did some things very well, some things not so well. We'll look at it again
on Monday.
I am having to learn to be less candid.
Sure.
Genuinely, because I am often like, yeah, I thought this was great, or like this was bad. And then the single biggest takeaway I've had from doing this is you get inside football, you get behind the velvet rope, and you are reminded of the most obvious thing in the world, but that we all forget, which is just a group of human beings.
Yeah.
It's like in any other job, it's like any other office. Some players don't like each other very much. Some players like each other loads. Mm. Some players, you know, we had all these situations, like, so Paul Mullen, for example, much made when we signed him, he's dropped from League Two's top goal scorer, should be going to League One, maybe a championship club. He's come to Wrexham because they've offered him bolt loads of money. Mm-hmm. He came to Wrexham because he got fed up driving from Liverpool to Cambridge every day.
Yeah.
And it was as simple as that. We pay him well. He's probably one of the best players in the division, probably, but I don't know what other teams are paying who. But it truly came down to him just being like, I can't face sitting in traffic around Cambridge when I'm trying to get back to my son.
Well, there's the other example of the player whose name I've forgotten from the documentary, who him and his partner's child passed away.
Jordan,
you kind of, you know, I watched that episode. It's obviously like horrifically sad, and then I sort of forget that happens, and I watch him playing football, and then they bring it back three episodes later, and I go, oh, he's been playing like this for the whole second half of the season. Like, that's horrifically
it's
sad.
It's 22
and it goes
years
from
old.
My head so quickly as I'm watching, you know.
No, totally. And it's that, you know, again, we all do it. We're all fans of various different teams and have a vested interest in them. And you know, you love when it's going well, and you know, but you don't fully comprehend. We had Sean Pearson, who was the Wrexham captain when we came in. He was kind of a bit of a club legend, certainly he had been, you know, a stalwart of the team for about 5 years, very popular figure, great guy, great captain. And we wanted to keep him on.
Mm.
Offered him a contract at the end of that season. The first half season that we took over, we were like, do you want to stay for another year or two? You know, be the captain. You might not be playing all the time, but you would be a very valuable figure. And he said yes. He was into it, shook hands, went home, came back the next day and was like, actually, I'm going to go to Grimsby. And we were like, oh, why? And he's like, well, my wife's family, we're from that area originally. Yeah. Her family are there. We've had a baby. We've spent the last, you know, period of time in lockdown, we haven't seen them very much, it would just make life way easier.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, fair enough. Fan base like, this, what's happening? We've lost our captain, where's he going? He's living his life. He's a 33-year-old man, he's got kids, he's got to look after them.
Human being.
He's a human being, and that's the thing that we all forget so much, is that it is human beings aplenty.
It's harder to get angry with them when you remember, isn't it?
Totally.
So that's why we forget.
Totally, totally, totally.
Anyway, Humphrey Carr, thank you so much for joining us.
Do you want to, I don't know, what's the name of the show you're working on? Can you tell us? Or no?
Yes, it's called American Auto. It's not on over here. So, but if you're an American person, you can
people
watch
are,
it.
People are listening, yeah, Americans. Yeah.
So it's on, I think you can watch it on Peacock in America. It's Peacock. On NBC normally, but it goes there. Which
what's
is,
Peacock?
Peacock's like a streaming service. And it's NBC's streaming service.
Oh.
It might be on Hulu as well. I'm not sure. But series two, we're filming right now. We reckon in the spring.
Well, all the best with Wrexham and with Peacock.
Thank you.
Yeah.
that's not what the show is called.
American Auto.
Yeah, exactly.
They're amazing. The Peacock, yeah, I mean, it's on Peacock. So.
Thanks, man.
Oh, Lordy. Thank you.